call this remote hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 10th, 2022, and we are holding this meeting remotely per Rule 10.01. We will start with the roll. Michaela, please go ahead.
Chair Becker Finn.
Here.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott. Representative Feist.
Okay. Present.
Representative Frazier. Representative Frazier. Representative Grossel. Representative Grossel. Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson?
Present.
Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Long?
Present.
Representative Mortensen?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
Present.
Representative Farr?
Present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Vang?
Present.
Representative Zhang?
Let's go ahead and call the two that weren't here the first time around.
All right. Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you. A quorum is present. It is the most wonderful time of the year when we all are bouncing around to different committees. So just let our staff know if that's going to be a problem. I also fall into that category today. So at some time in the next 10 minutes, I will be passing the gavel to Vice Chair Mueller for a bit. First on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from Tuesday. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes from March 8th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Frazier beat you to it. Frazier moves the minutes of March 8th, 2022. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. The first bill we're going to move today, so as we talked about last Thursday, with the other court document fee bills, there is a third bill that might actually be moving in the Senate. So that third bill is House File 3920, which I will move in front of us. It is the only way that this bill is different is that it completely gets rid of the $8 fee for any copies, uncertified copies, whether paper or virtual. Is there any discussion to this bill? Otherwise, I'm going to lay it over, and once we have all the fiscal notes and we're in the finance part of the year, we'll figure it out. All right. With that, House File 3920 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, members. Next on the agenda, I just want to make sure we've got Representative Ryer here. All right. Representative Ryer, we're going to do your bill first. So I will move House File 2463 be referred to the General Register. I do see you have a couple testifiers, but we will go to you first to introduce the bill. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I just want to clarify the bill path, whether we want this to go to General Register or Health. My understanding is that that should come to the Health Program Health Committee first. So if we could re-refer.
Got it. You're the chief author. So. I will amend my motion to move that House File 2463 be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Good job being on top of your bill. Now, please tell us about House File 2463.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. So I'm here today to talk about House File 2463. It's a bill that requires landlords to test their properties for radon, to disclose the results to tenants, and to mitigate radon if found. This is the second hearing for this bill, coming here from its first stop in the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. We received valuable feedback and are preparing some changes The amendment's not yet complete, but we'll have it ready for its next stop in the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, assuming we move forward. And the most substantive change is the addition of a grant fund similar to the Lead Safe Homes Program, added in recognition of the public health importance of this legislation. This is a basic safety bill. As you all likely know, and you'll hear more about today, radon poses serious health threats to people who are exposed to it. And because radon is odorless, colorless, and tasteless, people are not aware when they're exposed. In Minnesota, radon exposure causes an estimated 600 deaths per year from lung cancer. These are avoidable deaths. We simply need to expand the Minnesota Radon Awareness Act to include rental properties. This should be a basic responsibility for people offering properties for rent. We owe it to the people of our state. I want to thank the University of Minnesota Law School Community Legal Partnership for Health Clinic for your efforts on this issue since 2018. Your determination and focus are greatly appreciated, and I hope that we can get this legislation passed this year. I ask you all for your support to vote this bill out of this committee and on to its next stop with Health, Finance, and Policy. Now, we have a number of testifiers here today who will explain the bill in more detail and who bring technical knowledge and represent personal experience. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to them.
All right. After I announce this person, I'm going to hand the virtual gavel over to Vice Chair Moeller. So first on the list, we have Carly Michaud. If you can introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair. So I'm Carly Michaud. I'm one of the student directors for the Community Legal Partnership for Health Clinic, and this is my second year working on this project. So this bill creates requirements for landlords and protection for tenants. And so the landlord requirements are to test, and then if that radon level is dangerous, to mitigate. And so this bill requires landlords to utilize a licensed radon professional once every 5 years, and then to disclose the results of those tests to current and prospective tenants. And within the radon professional licensing, they have their own standards, they have a process and know how to accurately measure in each building. And so that is not something the landlord has to worry about. And then the tenants are protected through this disclosure and then the mediation if the level is dangerous. So it increases education, it gives tenants this level of protection for themselves by knowing whether there is radon, and then of course by actually mitigating when it's dangerous. So we've received some thoughtful feedback and concerns from the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. And our clinic students have been working with the representative on creating that grant program. So even though the language is not done right now, we're looking at least $1 million a year in the biennium for mitigation and testing that would be available for landlords. And so one of our witnesses who was at Housing is not available today. So I thought I would share a little bit of her testimony. Jacqueline Siewert is the program director of Live Smoke Free with the Association for Non-Smokers, Minnesota. And so her primary job is concerned with indoor air quality, works on smoke-free housing policy. And she shared how radon is a problem in her own home, and she has a radon mitigation system. And then told us a story about how her former next-door neighbors who were renting their home did a radon test, particularly because their children's bedrooms were in the basement. And these neighbors found elevated levels of radon. They asked their landlord to install a mitigation system and he declined. And so these neighbors ended up moving because of the concern over radon and not being able to afford to install that mitigation system themselves. And so this story she shared really demonstrates the serious need for tenant protections that this bill would create. And I'm happy to stick around and answer any questions related to the bill text.
Thank you, Ms. Michaud. Next up, we have Professor William Engel.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the committee and you can begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is William Angel. I'm chairman of the board of a group entitled Cancer Survivors Against Radon, and we represent cancer survivors and their next of kin who believe radon in their homes was a major factor in their lung cancer. Also, this issue is personal for me. I'm one of those next of kin. I lost a brother, 38-year-old brother-in-law who never smoked to lung cancer, and I lost a 62-year-old mother-in-law as well to lung cancer, and again, a never smoker. Radon is the most likely cause of their deaths. In Minnesota, radon in rental housing causes somewhere between 200 and 300 lung cancer deaths per year. Yet this is an important segment of our population that's been largely forgotten. And this bill extends awareness and protection to an important segment of our population. It's also reasonable in as much as it gives a 5-year period for landlords and property owners to comply with the testing requirements. There are national standards in place, consensus-based standards that guide them in that process. It's also supported by one of the nation's best, Minnesota Department of Health's radon programs in the country. And so I ask you to support this bill. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those. Incidentally, before I leave, I'll just say the last 35 years of my career or past has been devoted to radon indoors and how you control that. And I've directed a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Regional Radon Training Center that has trained people to do this testing and mitigation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Angel, and I'm sorry about mispronouncing your name, and I'm even more deeply sorry for the losses that you have endured. The next testifier is Kyle Berndt. Mr. Berndt, please introduce yourself and go ahead and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Berndt. I am the Director of Public Policy with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, known as MHA. MHA is an industry nonprofit representing 1,800 members and 300,000 rental housing units in the state. I am here to respectfully raise MHA's opposition to House File 2463. We appreciate the author's concerns for radon exposure in housing, but believe this bill misses the mark. After consultation with some MHA members, they said that when a building is purchased and in some cases refinanced, the radon tests are being regularly conducted at the requirements of the federal loan providers and life company financing groups. These groups will require testing and remediation if elevated levels are found for properties that are financed. This is a specific example in this proposal where we should look at exemption to not require additional testing when this sort of testing has been done. Today, we have a better understanding of the ways that radon collects and how it can be remediated. Under the proposal, testing is required every 5 years and provides no exemptions regardless for the different housing characteristics that exist. As an example, a housing unit which already has a remediation system designed and installed will continue to be professionally tested. Another example is when a housing unit that is atop an underground parking garage. These parking facilities are already required to be ventilated for exhaust fumes and should be considered for an exemption. There are other examples where an exemption could also be considered. The proposal includes a requirement that all testing must be conducted by licensed professionals. With an immediate 5-year time frame for the first test, in 5 years, Minnesota could face a serious shortage of available professional staff and testing capabilities. Another issue is the ability to install a radon remediation system within 120 days. Some structures require unique remediation systems, which can delay through permitting and installation of the system. A 120-day timeframe may prove difficult to achieve in those sort of cases. MHA believes that the broad disclosure is unnecessary and should be specific to units on the floor and floors below testing positive for radon. broader disclosure should only be required to other floors if the community rooms or other rooms or common spaces are on a floor with an elevated radon test. And after some further consideration of the bill, we're a little concerned about how the proposal will be implemented. 504B does not have a regulatory agency overseeing this section of law, and the proposal remains vague on implementation and exemptions for other conducted radon tests. We wonder whether this proposal would be better served under the supervision of the Department of Labor and Industry or the Department of Health. I hear from many of my members that some city rental license inspectors who are currently seem to be the ones that would be in charge of this have difficulty performing inspections every 5 years. And it remains to be seen how this additional regulatory burden to track this information would impact local inspectors. And I appreciate what Representative Ryer had mentioned about looking for some ways to finance this. In talking to some MHA members, the costs usually land between $100 and $150 per room professionally tested. So depending on the number of rooms that you test, these numbers could become pretty substantial pretty quickly. If it was every room, I had one member who told me that they'd have to spend $500,000 every 5 years for testing alone. It is important that testing and mitigation efforts are fully funded to ensure there's affordability and it's not negatively impacted. The mandates on this, if not funded, fall hardest on the providers in the cities where there's rent control, such as St. Paul, where they've adopted the most restrictive rent control policy in the country. These added costs could jeopardize housing viability in that specific community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in committee, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne. Before we move on to member questions, Representative Ryer, would you like to address some of those comments?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I would. There are a couple things regarding the radon testing being done at the time of financing. That's a good thing. We still need a communication mechanism to share that information with prospective and current tenants. It is a problem to me that tenants are out of the loop and not informed. And also, we know from the testimony in housing that repeated tests, even if there has been remediation, are important because underground characteristics change. It's the geology of it that the rocks beneath the surface can shift and radon can be released. That came up actually from Representative Tice. So I think it's important that we have at least that once every 5 years. Incidentally, the EPA is now, excuse me, talking about every 2 years. We are not going to that level. We are also, to the question about 120 days, I didn't mention it in my remarks, but we're also looking at that. And if there's some way that we can adjust that language so that it has to do with a good faith effort at undertaking, depending on the complexity of the remediation that's required. Finally, I would, I just want to say that I think bringing rent control into this discussion is not a particularly relevant point. It's this is a statewide initiative. This is a public health initiative. We are recognizing the public health aspect of it by not putting all of the financial requirements on the landlord through our grant program, which will be proposed. But I do think that acknowledging the risk to people that radon poses and the absolute lack of protection right now that tenants have, it's important and we need to go through it, you know, proceed with this. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryer, for bringing this bill forward. You know, I'm interested in this, but I just feel like we don't know enough about what the actual bill will be. You talk about there will be a lot of changes and there's a grant program and someone mentioned maybe $1 million this biennium. Like, I don't feel comfortable voting on it when it sounds like there's really substantial changes coming in future committees. So could you just give us a little bit more specifics? I appreciate that you're looking at the flexibility on the 120 days, but could you just spell out for us, like if there is a DE, more specifically how this grant program will operate, how much we're talking about? And when you mean, when the testifier said this biennium, do you mean the current biennium we are in, or in a future, the next biennium? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And before you answer, Representative Breyer, too, I just note that this this is going back to the Health Committee, and that our scope of discussion is a little bit more narrow as the Judiciary Committee. But go right ahead and explain what that amendment you envision will be.
So just going back and clarifying, I would like first for Ms. Michaud to clarify the timeline of implementation of this, because I think it's going to be very important. This is not something that landlords will be required to start doing on a dime, so to speak. But Ms. Michaud, if you could clarify that, please, with your permission.
Yep, go ahead, Ms. Michaud.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Breyer. So my understanding of the timeline is that the effective date would start this year, and that efficacy date starts the timeline. So 5 years out would be 2027. And then regarding the bienniums, I meant 2022, 2023 is what we were looking at currently with language.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to Ms. Michaud and Representative Breyer. So we're in that biennium. So we're talking about creating a grant program for the biennium that we're currently in.
Representative Breyer.
No, I'll correct that. That would be 2023-2024 biennium.
Representative Robbins.
Okay, thank you. I'd also like to have you speak to what other flexibilities you're looking at briefly, if you have a minute. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Breyer, and then we'll move on to other questions by members. Go ahead, Representative Breyer.
It's the two representative, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Robbins. It's the two items, the adding the grant program and looking at that mitigation date. Those were the two pieces of feedback that we thought raised really valid points. We want this to be a workable program that landlords will be able to work with and their tenants will be able to benefit from. We aren't trying to set up a program that's hard for them to achieve. So we're looking at those two things.
All right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Breyer, for bringing this piece of legislation. I'm frankly kind of surprised that this isn't a requirement already. I'm having flashbacks to our discussions about carbon monoxide detectors last session and whether or not Airbnbs need to have them in there and rental units and hotels need to have them in there. This seems like a common sense preventative measure that could save people a lot of heartache. And I know in my district, a lot of my renters are long-term renters. They're not like here and there and moving around. They stay in those houses. I've got neighbors that have raised their whole family in houses. And if they are not, you know, if they're being poisoned unknowingly, I think that's something that absolutely needs to be addressed. So I thank you for bringing this legislation. My question is for your testifier, Ms. Michaud. I'm wondering if there has been any, if there is any liability currently for landlords in this area, and if there's been any known, you know, civil lawsuits about this particular issue and the repercussions of radon poisoning.
Ms. Michaud.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hollins. At this time, we had started to look into this question and we didn't see anything regarding a specific duty or any cases that have gone forward. Other students and I had talked to a couple housing attorneys and asked this question. And what we heard back from Housing Aid, Housing Justice attorneys was that it has not been tried, but it would be a very difficult argument. One housing attorney said they have had issues getting settlements for mold. And mold, you can see, you know the health effects there, they can be fairly immediate. And so based on that, the attorneys we talked to couldn't think of any cases that had come up. Our research didn't find any. So at least in Minnesota, we're unaware of any radon cases. As far as existing duties, there is a general duty for habitability. And so that is what we were looking for cases. Had anyone argued that radon is part of that duty? We believe it is, and this bill does not change that at all. This just adds an additional layer of protection.
All right, Representative Scott.
On this bill, and I just wanted to comment a little bit on
Representative Scott. We're having a little bit of difficulty hearing. Are you able to get closer to your mic?
Yeah, is that better? Hello?
Yeah, that's much better. Thank you.
That's so weird. I have the volume turned way up. I've never had a problem. Am I too loud? Am I okay?
Okay.
So I just wanted to comment on the rent control issue and why it is pertinent to this conversation. And it's really more of a general piling on that housing providers are experiencing right now, particularly those in St. Paul, where this rent control is in place. And the more expenses that the housing providers have without being able to raise their rents commensurately, the fewer units you're going to have available to people to rent, and we do have a housing shortage. So it's just more that piling on effect, I think, is what the gentleman from the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association was getting at. But I do have some questions about, so let's say you have a five-story building with 300 units. Is each unit to be tested? And is each floor to be tested under this bill?
Who wants to take that? Is Mashad or Representative Ryer? So whoever unmutes first, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Representative Scott, and thank you, Madam Chair. As I understand the testing protocols, and they are established in EPA guidelines, which Ms. Mashad could speak to. When you have multi-stories, you test from the bottom up. If the ones closest to the ground are clear, you don't need to test above. If they are not, you need to test the next levels to be able to determine that floors 3, 4, and 5 don't have the same issues that floors 1 and 2 have. However, if floors 1 and 2 are fine, my understanding is that the subsequent floors are also deemed fine. So it's really case by case. It's dependent on the situation in the building itself. Ms. Mashad, would you?
Actually, Representative Ryer, in the sake of interest, I see a number of members have also raised their hands. And okay. Let's keep on going with the questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would also like to know if each room and each unit has to be tested. Can you still not hear me?
You're breaking in and out, sorry.
Yeah. You're good now. Just okay. Stay right where you are.
You can probably see the pores of my skin. I'm so close to the camera. But so I would also like to know if each room in each unit needs to be tested. There's just, and I was looking up for a summary of what a mitigation system may cost. And maybe $500. So would each unit be required to have a $500 mitigation unit? Those are all questions that I have that aren't clear in this bill.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. Those types of details are spelled out in guidelines. We can send you a link to that information. However, I would just remind you that we are sensitive to the costs to landlords, and that is the reason for having a proposed grant program, which unfortunately, and I do apologize, and I acknowledge also Representative Robbins' concern about not having that amendment in time for this hearing.
All right, we're going to move on to other member questions at this point. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mueller, Representative Ryer, thank you for this. Radon is an issue. It's an issue in Minnesota. The average home in Minnesota is about 4.5. The safe level is stated to be about 4 by EPA. But I'm wondering, again, about testing. To get an accurate test for radon, how long does that test have to run?
Representative Ryer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Not being a housing inspector or expert on that type of thing, I don't know how long it takes to get a sufficient reading. However, I do know that tests are estimated between $100 and $150, which to me seems to be the relevant factor in considering impact on landlords.
And maybe I'll just, Ms. Michaud, could you answer that question too, if you could answer that quickly?
I am not sure. I actually think Mr. Angel might be able to answer this better than I can.
All right, Mr. Angel.
Yes, Madam Chair. The minimum length of a test is 48 hours. Thank you. And also in terms of mitigation of larger buildings, multifamily buildings, duplexes on up, usually one system per building is what's required to mitigate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mueller, members to the test project, thank you for your answer. But actually, if you actually do some research, to get an accurate test that according to the EPA, it takes 90 days to run that test. And these home tests that you're talking about are not that accurate. They give an idea, but for the professionals to come in, it's a 90-day test before they can get the information. Then they have to spend another, I'm not sure how long, figuring out design what and looking at the property, looking at the soil to figure out what's the mitigation needs to be done. That 100, and your 120 days is gone almost before they can even start a project. This bill, I believe, needs a lot of work. I like the concept. We do need to deal with radon, but a simple air exchanger will reduce radon levels. And most new housings now, for I don't know how many, for the past 20, 25 years, have required air exchangers in them as well, which do reduce the radon levels. So I think I don't think this bill is quite ready yet. It needs a lot of work. I can't support it this time, so.
All right, thank you, Representative Johnson. I'm gonna turn this back over to Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller, for handling things in my absence. We're gonna go to Representative Liebling, and then we gotta get rolling. We got a full agenda, and I don't wanna keep you guys here any longer next Tuesday than I need to. Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So as chair of the Health Committee, I thought I should really weigh in here. I mean, first of all, we got to remember, refocus ourselves. What we're talking about here is people's lives and health. And in any of our homes, we would never allow our children to be sleeping in poisonous gas if we could do something about it, if we knew that it was happening, right? So, I mean, that's what this is about. I also want to remind members that when we vote out a bill here, the motion is to re-refer the bill to somewhere. It's not, yes, this bill is perfect. In fact, we rarely have, yes, this bill is perfect. This bill is not going to the floor. It is going to the Health Committee. And there's been some discussion about some things that Representative Ryer has heard and learned in this committee, which is what committees are for, folks. So I would just say, get a grip. This is about moving a bill that is doing something very, very important that frankly should have been done before. And I remember several years ago, and it was Representative Kim Norton, and that's why I remember, who managed to put through the initial radon protections, which is that when you build a new home, you have to build in some radon protections. But because this is such a vast problem, we were unable to get to all the ramifications. And Minnesotans are still being poisoned by radon gas. We have a real problem in this state. So let's move this bill. Let's not make any excuses for it. It's not, oh, this bill isn't perfect. Of course it isn't perfect. This is a complicated problem. I really appreciate that Representative Ryer is taking it on and working it. And I'm sure she's taking in all of the concerns and is going to work with all of the stakeholders, because this is a complicated bill. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Question for one of the housing providers or maybe the author, and it's fairly short. Is there anything preventing a renter from purchasing their own testing kits or monitors?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. Of course, nothing prevents them from doing that. There's also nothing that requires a landlord to do remediation, as we heard in the testimony.
So, and I'm sorry I missed the testimony, but just so we're clear, even if a renter did the test, it's not their property. They would still need the landlord to do the work to fix it so that it's safe. Correct, Representative Ryer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct. And the landlord has no obligation to do that.
Okay. Representative Novotny, any further questions? Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer, for the bill. Did hear this in housing as well, so I do appreciate Representative Liebling's comments on get a grip. But you know, these are the same questions that are a lot of the same questions that we heard days ago, and there's still no answers to them. So appreciate that comment, Representative Liebling. My question quickly is, if we have an issue in the facility, we put a mitigation system in, I'm unclear as to why we wouldn't have to continue testing that every 5 years. I understand that things change, rocks shift, but if we're mitigating radon, why have to test that again in 5 years? Shouldn't that then be checked off the box, checked off the list and be cleared?
And I'll just, it's a little bit outside of the scope of this committee, but real quick, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Farr. You'll also recall in the hearing in housing, our colleague, Representative Tice, commenting that in their own home where they have a mitigation system, they test every 5 years because conditions change and they want to be sure they're safe.
All right, Representative Scott. And I'm sorry, Representative Scott, you're going to have to come real close to the mic again.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can.
Okay. Show me the spots that I missed on my teeth brushing this morning. I'm sure you can probably see that. No, I just wanted to comment on Representative Liebling saying that we should get a grip. This bill is in our committee for a reason, and we have legitimate questions about how this is going to operate going forward. And it's important to know the answers to these questions, because $1 million grant for something that may be an expense for one housing provider of $500,000 every 5 years, that is substantial. $1 million is not going to cover that. And no one is saying that radon isn't an important issue. It is. It's an important health issue. But I think telling us to get a grip is not statesmanlike. And I was disappointed to hear Representative Liebling say that. And I just wanted to get that on the record, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. I'm back. I missed some of the conversation, but if we can all get on track and do our work and move forward, that would be good, because we've got a full agenda. Seeing no other questions, Representative Ryer, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, everyone, for your comments. I will say that we have addressed many of the concerns that were raised in housing. I do regret that we don't have the completed amendment for you all to see, but I think the verbal assurances that we've given you should reassure Representative Farr that they were heard and are being acted on. I want to raise one last aspect of this that came out, and that, yes, newer housing has radon protection. we have a lot of older housing stock in Minnesota, and a lot of the, and this is an equity issue, a lot of the people who are living in the older housing stock are from communities that are at greater health risk anyway, are Black and brown communities, and we have an obligation to say all communities, all people in the state have a right to a safe and healthy home, regardless of how old their housing is or where they live. Thank you.
All right, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2463 be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Mueller?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Farr?
Farr, no.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right, the motion prevails. House File 2463 is on its way to Health, Finance, and Policy. Moving right along, I see Representative Howard is got his camera on and ready to go. I will move that House File 2860 be referred to the General Register. I see that you have an author's amendment, the A5 amendment. You can just nod. Do you want me to move the A5? All right, I will move the A5 amendment. Representative Howard, please tell us briefly what the A5 does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A5 amendment takes some feedback we heard from Minnesota Multi-Housing to improve the bill in a few ways and add more detail to meet the intent of the underlying bill.
All right. Any discussion to the A5 amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the motion prevails. The A5 is adopted. Representative Howard, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 2860 is a bill born out of our experience with the renter-landlord relationship during the pandemic and during the period where we had an eviction moratorium and an eviction moratorium off-ramp. As policymakers, I believe we want to learn from this time and be able to improve systems going forward. And one aspect of the legislation we passed to off-ramp from the eviction moratorium off-ramp that was brought forward by the Senate majority was a provision to prevent evictions while renters had an open rental assistance claim with RentHelp MN. And the goal of such a provision was a win-win for renters and for landlords so that we can ensure that landlords were made whole and that renters were able to avoid the black mark of an eviction. And this policy has worked well in the off-ramp and has benefited landlords to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. And it has helped renters maintain their housing stability. We believe that this policy has merit, not just during a pandemic, but in perpetuity. In doing so, we encourage the kind of communication between renters and landlords that are mutually beneficial, so that if a renter has fallen behind, they've lost hours at their job, they're sick, et cetera, yet they can get the emergency rental assistance they need to catch up, and we get that win-win. And on the flip side, if a renter has an open rental assistance application and they end up being evicted before it can be paid, that is a lose-lose. The landlord does not collect the rent that is owed and has to proceed through a costly eviction process. The renter loses their home and has the black market eviction, which will follow them for years and years. And it's completely avoidable. And that is what this bill will address. It's a common sense way we can improve renter-tenant law in a way that is mutually beneficial to renters and landlords. And to speak a little more specifically to the amendment we adopted, we added greater definition to what rental assistance is in law to provide more clarity of what would qualify. And we also provided a timing mechanism. for when this when this protection would be in place. One of the pieces of feedback we heard from landlords about this provision during the eviction moratorium off-ramp was the length of time it would take for and a rental assistance application to be filled and not really having a sense of when it would be filled. And so we put some timelines into this legislation to provide a clear idea of what this looks like, both for renters and for landlords. With that, I would turn it over to my first testifier, Eric Hauge from Homeline.
All right, Eric, if you can introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2860. My name is Eric Hauge. I'm the Executive Director of Homeline, which is a statewide tenant advocacy organization. Our main program is a free and confidential legal hotline for renters that has advised over 275,000 households since opening 30 years ago. We're continuing to see the impacts of the pandemic on our clients. Renters are still continuing to experience uncertainty and instability. We've seen a dramatic increase in renters contacting us about housing instability while they're waiting for rental assistance. Right now, we're averaging around 50 calls a day with questions about evictions, lease terminations, and people seeking financial aid. And that's why this the reasonable approach in this bill is really necessary, and it's proven, as Representative Howard mentioned. It'll provide needed assistance and stability to tenants while ensuring payment of rental assistance to landlords. I won't go into much more detail since Representative Howard did cover the core of the bill. I'll just note that, again, as you mentioned, the eviction moratorium phase out or off-ramp law passed last year instituted a very similar protection for rental assistance applications. Throughout that time, we advised hundreds of households throughout the state about how their pending application would protect them from an eviction. So we know firsthand that the policy kept hundreds, if not thousands, in their homes while landlords were paid up adequately. One recommendation that we did share in the Housing Committee is just how beneficial the pairing of this policy could be with a pre-eviction notice requirement. Again, something that was in last year's eviction moratorium phase out and which isn't included within House File 835 that this committee considered last week. Ensuring tenants are aware of how much is owed and that there actually are rental assistance programs available to them is a really common sense yet extremely useful practice. You'd be surprised how many people we spoke to over the past year who just simply were not aware of the availability of rental assistance. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify and urge your support of House File 2860.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Luke Grundman. If you can introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Howard. My name is Luke Grundman. I am litigation director at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Legal aid lawyers represent hundreds of low-income families in eviction cases every year. Madam Chair, this bill avoids unnecessary evictions, as Representative Howard and Mr. Hauge have already testified to. I just want to draw one picture for the committee that I think is important here. I mean, before the pandemic in Hennepin County, there were 6,500 evictions every year. At the same time, there are thousands of people who are homeless in Hennepin County. Half of those people are children. But we had 11 million dollars appropriated to Hennepin County to spend on emergency assistance specifically to prevent evictions. Almost half of that money went unspent or spent on other things besides emergency housing. So how do we have all these evictions and all these folks who are homeless when there's this money that's designed to prevent that? Well, the answer was that it couldn't get to them in time. People would apply and they wouldn't get the money before they were evicted. And so for the past 6 months, we've had a test run of this legislation. It's been a resounding success. We asked for data from the courts. 20% of the cases that have been filed where there were pending rent help applications were put on hold. The landlords got their money, the tenants were able to save their homes. And as Representative Howard said, it was a win-win. You know, I have one client who comes to mind I just want to tell you about quickly. This client, she's 23 years old. She's a single mom living in her first apartment. She had her hours cut unexpectedly, fell behind on rent, applied right away for rent help. And unfortunately, though, that application was denied. It was due to a technicality, there was a, she had used a phone number that that her sister had also used for the same, for an application. And so they thought it was a duplicate application. They denied it, and she was in court facing eviction. But because of the existing protection, she applied for rent help. That application was pending. Her eviction was put on hold. The landlord is in the process now of getting paid, and she's in the process of keeping her home. Without that protection, members of the committee, you can just imagine how her life would go in a different direction. You know, she's young, starting off with a kid. If she had been evicted, she'd have an eviction record. It would have made that, it would have made it almost impossible for her to find safe and healthy housing for herself and her child. But thanks to that provision in previous legislation, that isn't what's going to happen. And she has the opportunity to keep herself and her kid in a home that's healthy and safe and doesn't begin that downward spiral of that contributes to poverty and additional evictions and additional issues in our society. So I just say again, this thing has prevented evictions. If this committee advances this bill, we'll save a lot of people from homelessness. It is a logical, basic solution, and I encourage the committee to vote yes on it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The last testifier I have on the list is Kyle Berndt. If you can introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Kyle Berndt with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I'm here today to respectfully raise our opposition to House File 2860. The proposal in front of the committee today would not allow for eviction action for non-payment of rent to move forward if an application for any federal, state, local, or other nonprofit rental assistance is pending. We are continuing to evaluate the A5 amendment that Representative Howard had adopted earlier and trying to figure out the impacts on how, if this, if we continue to have some of our concerns that we raised in the Housing Committee that he sought to address with it. However, some issues still exist with this proposal. Some local jurisdictions have adopted several different timelines for a notice period prior to filing an eviction. These ordinances add a layer of complexity as they reflect a patchwork of policies in the state. As an example, the City of Brooklyn Center recently adopted a 30-day notice requirement that must be provided prior to filing an eviction. This standard would provide someone until the 29th day to make a rental assistance application for emergency rental assistance through Hennepin County. At that point, Hennepin County would have to process the application. As we heard from other testifiers, applications can take a while to process, and they've been known to take over 30 days to process. At the end of that duration, if the application is rejected, housing providers would be on the hook for the unpaid rent, potentially for more than 60 days. The impact of this policy could be devastating, especially for smaller operators with few units to offset these costs. Finally, housing providers in Minnesota know that the best business practice is to avoid evictions and keep tenants stably in their homes. Rental owners and operators regularly work with local and county programs for emergency rental assistance for their residents and to understand, and they understand that these values that these can bring for both them and for the resident and themselves. And let's not forget that Minnesota has a strong deterrent to evictions through the state's $300 filing fee and a requirement that in most courts, housing providers must hire attorneys to represent them. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, Madam Chair, committee members.
All right, that's the end of the testifier list. We do have another amendment. I don't believe it's a friendly amendment, so I held off on it and let you do your presentation. Representative Howard, I believe it's a Representative Novotny amendment. Representative Novotny, if you would like to move your amendment.
That is my motion, Chair.
All right. Representative Novotny, please tell us about the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Chair. And I think it's friendly. But currently, if I look at the Oxford Dictionary for landlord, the opening line is, it's a noun, a person, especially a man. The term landlord is English-based. I think changing to the suggested language that I have in this amendment would make housing provider more inclusive, non-gender specific, and would encompass both private and publicly held properties. I think it's time to move into the 20th century with our terminology and, as I said, be more inclusive. That is my motion.
Thank you, Representative Votny. Well, I appreciate your dedication to inclusiveness. Luckily, we do not follow the Oxford Dictionary when it comes to Minnesota statute. So I would recommend that folks look at Chapter 504B.001 under definitions. We actually call it the landlord-tenant area of statute. If you look at Subdivision 7, we do have a definition of landlord that is not man-specific. Landlord means an owner of real property, a contract for deed, vendee, receiver, executor, trustee, lessee, agent, or other person directly or indirectly in control of rental property. So I would recommend that folks take a look at that. Again, it's 504B.0001. Representative Howard, what any thoughts on the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair and Representative Novotny, I would encourage a no vote, and the chair did a good job of explaining why. We already have this relationship pretty clearly defined in statute. I know there's been a lot of discussion about this terminology, but I don't think our state statutes are a good place to wage a rebranding campaign. So I would encourage a no vote.
Representative Scott, to the amendment. Oh, now we can't. There you go.
Actually, Madam Chair, I had my hand up to comment on the bill. So
okay.
I put it down.
All right. Well, we will go to a vote on the amendment. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
All right. The amendment does not pass. The A3 amendment fails, but thank you, Representative Votny, for bringing it forward. Now moving on to this discussion of the bill as amended by the A5, Representative Scott. And we can't hear you again.
Madam Chair, if you want to go to somebody else, I'll try to figure this out.
Okay, and if you need to call in on the phone so we can hear you clearly, that's an option as well. Other members to the bill. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Howard, I do have a question for you. In your bill, granted, you do have some timelines in there, but how many different times, what I'm wondering, how many different times a renter can actually apply for, between the state, the federal, the local, different resources for rental assistance, how many different times can they apply and put a halt on the eviction process from the housing provider until they can actually go? Because if they can do it the first time, delay it 60 days, then another 60 days, then another 60 days. We could go 6-8. You could actually push the eviction process well out over a year. I'm just wondering how many different times can they apply before the process can go forward?
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. I would point out the amendment we adopted does indicate that if a rental assistance application is denied, an eviction could proceed. And I might phone a friend of some of my testifiers. Various rental assistance that's called out in the bill does have, depending on the form of assistance, isn't necessarily accessible in perpetuity, depending on the form. But I'm not super well versed on each. And so I'm curious if one of my testifiers had more information to share.
All right, Mr. Grundman, quickly, if you will, we've got two other bills on the agenda today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, appreciate that. I'll just say quickly that it differs by program. There are programs that restrict applications to once per year. Emergency assistance, emergency general assistance are in that capacity. RentHelp had an 18-month total months of payment as a limit. So, and then the other programs have different limits as well. So it varies a little bit by program to answer that question.
All right, thank you. Now, Representative Scott.
Okay, is that any better?
Yes.
Oh, yay. Good.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Howard, just a couple of questions. Do you think that tenants or renters know that they owe rent every month?
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. Generally speaking, yes. I think that we should strive to encourage as much communication as possible. When folks fall behind sometimes, I think life gets in the way. You might not know exactly what you need to come up to current. That's partly why a pre-eviction notice would be that information. I hope that responds to your question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Howard, people know when they sign a lease when the rent is due. And I think a tenant also has some responsibility here. If they're not going to be able to pay their rent and they know that they contact the housing provider that they signed the lease with to let them know they're having struggles. As housing provider, I know what programs are available to help them. And I agree 100% with you that there needs to be a line of communication. And what your bill is doing here is saying there isn't one, that we're just going to automatically make the housing provider wait 45 days. And by that time, these people are now 2 months behind. And if they never get assistance, if they don't qualify for it, I know at one time, some of the assistance programs, if you lost your job and things weren't going to turn around for you, you know, the next couple of months, you were ineligible. You could get emergency assistance if you had a car breakdown and it was sort of a temporary financial setback. But some of these programs, you know, if your circumstances into the future don't look good, they don't provide this emergency assistance. We've directed people to churches, to nonprofits, because we want to work with people. As you stated earlier, housing providers don't want turnover. They don't want people, they don't want to evict people. It's super expensive. Our leases say your rent is due by the 5th of the month. If you haven't paid by the 10th, the landlord may file an eviction notice. So I think that's ample time. They've got 10 days to communicate with the housing provider that they're having trouble meeting the rent. This bill is not necessary. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Didn't sound like there was a question necessarily. So Representative Howard, we'll go to your closing comments so we can get to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for the comments, Representative Scott. I guess what I would say is this bill is necessary and would have a very positive impact, both renters and landlords, as the testimony has indicated and as the practice during the eviction moratorium has indicated. It provides a path for renters to access rental assistance that ends up in the pockets of landlords and creates that win-win. And one last piece to the timing, I get that this may back up the time in which a landlord is going to get their check, but I just want to juxtapose that with the time that an eviction is on a person's record. That follows someone's record for 7 years. To require kind of a 30-day period for a rental assistance application to be open seems more than fair, given that context. And thank you for the discussion. I would encourage support of the bill.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 2860 as amended be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Mueller?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier? Representative Frazier? Representative Grossel?
I'll vote for me and Frazier and say no. Can I do that? No. Mine is no.
Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long? Representative Long? Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
Aye, no.
Representative Farr?
Farr, no.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That is 8 ayes and 7 nays.
Frazier votes aye.
Oh, Frazier. All right. Thank you, Representative Frazier. So 9-7, the motion prevails. House file 2860, as amended, is on its way to the general register. The next bill on our agenda, members, is House File 3098, a Representative Egbadje bill. I will move House File 3098 be referred to the general register. Representative Egbadje, if you can tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you to members of the committee. Today, I'm here to present House File 3098 that will allow tenants to bring forward habitability defenses when faced with an eviction without having to first pay the rent that is actually at issue in the case. So the current practice in Minnesota amounts to a violation of due process by requiring tenants to pay the disputed amount before into courts before a judge will even hear substandard living condition defenses to an eviction. The purpose of this bill is to ensure that referees and judges engage in a trial of the issues in an eviction before making a decision that can lead to detrimental outcomes to a person and their family. Landlord-tenant codifies that the landlord and tenant enter into a covenant of habitability when they sign a lease. And so this means that tenants must pay rent and landlords must keep the premises livable. Yet we know that there are landlords who do not keep up with their end of the lease. And recently in the media, we have heard of landlords that do not provide heat, do not address infestation of mice and pests, and do not fix plumbing issues. In these types of cases, we see that some landlords would rather evict a tenant than make those repairs. And in Minnesota, when tenants are faced with a landlord who does not keep up with their end of the covenant and then tries to evict, the tenant does have a right to bring up the living conditions of the unit as a defense to the eviction if the rent has not been paid. But even with the ability to bring habitability defenses, also known as Fritz defenses, courts in Minnesota have created an arbitrary rule that a tenant must pay that disputed amount of rent to the court before it will even hear the defense. And if the tenant does not pay, then the case is decided in favor of the landlord and no issues about the living conditions are heard or decided upon. Practically, this means that some of our lowest income community members who are living in substandard housing cannot even defend themselves in court against a landlord's eviction. If we do not put a stop to this practice, justice continues to be out of reach for most of our vulnerable neighbors. We've heard that some concerns about this bill that it'll deter tenants from pursuing rent escrow cases, but those types of cases are a little bit different because the tenant is taking an affirmative action in that case, and they do have to provide notice to the landlord, and so the landlord can then either make repairs or prepare defense. But in an eviction, the landlord is the one taking the affirmative action. And without updating this law, tenants have no real notice, and they also, a line of defense that should be open to them essentially becomes unusable. And so this bill would remove that procedural burden in eviction cases where tenants are often distressed and have limited resources to protect themselves. This bill does not change the requirement for a tenant to post rent if the tenant wants to appeal an adverse ruling. And the bill's purpose is to ensure access to the courts for tenants who have defenses to eviction from a landlord who does not provide habitable living conditions as required by the lease. And so today I have Mary Kazurek from the Minnesota Legal Aid who can help speak on more of the practical benefits of this bill. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Kazurek, if you can introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Mary Kaczorek. I work for Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. We are a civil legal aid organization that has been helping renters in Minnesota for over 100 years. I'm an attorney in the housing unit in our Minneapolis office, and my testimony today is based on my experience representing hundreds of renters in Hennepin County. As Representative Egbadje has described, a lease is a two-way street. When there are repair problems, it's up to the court to decide how much rent the tenant owes. The court looks at the rent amount and then looks at the problems. They look at what the problems were, how long they lasted, how severe they were, and then makes a decision about whether and how much money the rent money the tenant owes. Many of the tenants I have helped cannot have that day in court because that rent money has been spent to fix the issues on their own. I remember a family with little kids that I helped that lived in an older home in South Minneapolis. This house had a ton of problems, and the landlord had been on notice for all of these things, but the landlord didn't fix them. There was a broken stove, and so the family was unable to cook, so they had to pay money to get fast food or restaurant food to feed the kids. There was no heat, so the family had to get space heaters to heat the home. There was a broken toilet, so the family had to hire their own plumber to get a functioning toilet. There was backed up sewage in the basement, so they had to hire their own cleaners to clean up sewage. This family couldn't pay the rent because that meant rent money was gone because they had spent it dealing with the issues on their own. Now, to clarify, this bill does not affect rent escrow cases. Tenants still have the affirmative right to get things fixed on their own through the rent escrow statute, through municipal rental licensing entities and other alternatives. This bill doesn't try to affect that. Instead, this bill recognizes the practical reality that many of these disputes arise in eviction cases for non-payment of rent. If a Minnesota renter who can't pay the rent faces eviction, they should not have to pay more money into court just to litigate the issue of how much rent they really owe. In the prior hearing, several examples were provided of where a litigant can post a bond. None of these examples affect a civil defendant's right to defend themselves on the merits of a case and litigate the underlying dispute. And none of these result in a family becoming homeless if they can't pay. The first two examples are for plaintiffs. So the first example provided was for eminent domain, and there the government entity must pay a bond into court, and that does not restrict the right of the landowner to litigate the underlying dispute. The next example was for litigants who file lawsuits to slow down bonding projects done by municipalities and others. This is again for plaintiffs. To file this case, the plaintiff has to post a bond. Next is a mechanics lien. This is an action by a contractor against a homeowner who doesn't pay their bill. It doesn't make the litigation itself contingent on the payment of the bond. If the homeowner wants the lien released pending the litigation, they pay a bond into court, but they still have the right to litigate the underlying dispute if they don't post that bond. The next example provided was attachment. This is when a defendant can get property back during an attachment, during litigation for attachment. They can pay into the court to get that property back in the meantime while the dispute is being litigated. If they don't pay the bond, they are not prevented from having a trial at all. And that, again, is the outcome in an eviction case if a tenant doesn't post the bond. And finally, the last example was for bail in a criminal proceeding. And again, that doesn't affect the accused right to litigate the case. In the last hearing, a testifier also stated that the court can reduce the bond amount to reflect costs that a tenant incurred to fix repair issues on their own. This is simply not true. This is not what happens in Hennepin County, and it doesn't happen in many other jurisdictions across the state. The stakes are so high in an eviction case. If a family loses, they become homeless. Families should not have to pay to defend their homes. This bill will remove this barrier and improve access to justice for renters who just want their day in court. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today, Madam Chair.
Yep, thank you. And now we'll go to Chris Kala, and we'll just remind folks that we've only got until 10 o'clock. So if we can pick up the pace and get to the points, that would be really great. Mr. Kala.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and Representative Akbaje. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Christopher Kala. I'm an attorney litigator with the law firm of Hanbury & Turner. We represent both landlords and property owners in both state and federal courts, all the way from trials through appeals, fair housing, rent escrow, and eviction actions. I offer this testimony to oppose HF 3098. I think there needs to be a point of clarification here. When Representative Akbaje talks about the disputed amount of rent, in court, when a tenant disputes the amount of rent in an eviction case, they are never required to post the rent with court that is disputed. There is an issue of whether that rent is at issue, whether it's been paid or not, but when the tenants say they have paid the rent, they are not required to post that same rent again with the court. The only time the court requires the posting of rent is when the tenant admits they haven't paid the rent. and yet wants to litigate a Fritz defense. That is the procedure outlined in the Fritz v. Worthen case from the Minnesota Supreme Court from 1973. Insofar as that's the Minnesota Supreme Court announcing the procedure, I think it's problematic to suggest that that procedure in and of itself is unconstitutional or doesn't provide due process. The remedy for an unconstitutional procedure outlined by the courts is to appeal that and explain why that's unconstitutional. I take issue with Ms. Kaczorek's suggestion that the court doesn't have the ability to discount the rent escrow by the amount the tenant paid to make the repairs. I routinely see that happen. If a tenant has paid a plumber to fix a toilet, if a tenant has obtained space heaters to ameliorate a lack of heat, has replaced a broken air conditioner in the summertime, routinely the courts discount the rent escrow by that amount. There is not a problem with this, with the current statute as written. The several suggestions from the last hearing regarding those six issues of prejudgment attachment, mechanics liens, those are merely examples in the civil and criminal litigation where a defendant, a person who's being put upon, has to put up before they can litigate. Sure, they can still litigate the case without putting up, but they lose something in the meantime. Tenants in Minnesota do not lose the right to litigate a case because they don't put up the amount of rent that they've already paid in court. I've never seen that happen. Never. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Members, any discussion to the bill? All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe a question to Mr. Kalla. Would you think, in your experience, because it sounds like you've had some pretty in-depth experience in the courtroom on these sorts of issues, in your experience, would you say that if this bill were to become law, that renters could delay paying their rent by making one of these claims?
Hold on, sir. We'll just point out we have two very experienced attorneys here, both of our testifiers today. Mr. Kalla.
Thank you, Representative Scott, Madam Chair. Absolutely, the suggestion that this statute wouldn't affect rent escrow cases, perhaps on the face is true, but the reality is in a rent escrow case, the requirement is a tenant posts the rent with the court in order to maintain the rent escrow action where the tenant is the plaintiff in housing court. But the case of Ellis v. Doe lays out clearly, and that's the Minnesota Supreme Court from 2019, that when the tenant wants to litigate a habitability defense, they're not required to give the landlord advance notice of any of the issues of habitability. And that's the point I was trying to make at the last hearing, is that this statute, if adopted, would lead to tenants not bringing rent escrow actions. They would sit and wait until the landlord files an eviction case. And then the tenant would tell the landlord, not necessarily having told the landlord before, all of the problems with the habitability of the apartment. And then the tenant doesn't have to post any of the rent. So if the landlord wants to wait 2 months before they bring the eviction, hoping, right, that the tenant is going to pay the rent, not understanding there's any habitability issues, correct. The tenant would have an incentive to delay the bringing of a rent escrow action, to delay the giving of notice to the landlord of habitability issues. That's what I think would happen.
All right, thank you. Closing comments. Oh, follow up. Sorry, your hand went down. Representative Scott, we've got another bill we got to get to.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. And that's kind of what I presumed. Not only that, but if the landlord brings the eviction proceeding, the landlord's already paid the filing fee. That's not on the defendant either. And I don't know, I could count on one finger the number of times that I've ever recovered late rent or filing fees from a tenant.
All right, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond to Mr. Kalla's remarks. I would caution us to put motives on tenants. As someone who has advised tenants, we don't really recommend tenants to wait until the landlord takes them to eviction court. We will recommend tenants to continue to communicate with the landlord about the issues they're experiencing in the housing. So I would advise caution testifiers to not put motives on tenants who on whether what kind of moves they're making to during the legal process. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vang. Closing comments, Representative Egbadje.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be brief as I can. So the purpose of this bill really is to correct a practice that's happening. And yes, on the in the law, you know, a tenant should not have to post their rent before litigating this issue, but that's not what's happening. And so we want to make it clear to the court system that they need to follow the law. In addition, this is also a defense. So no tenant is actually bringing forward anything. These are defenses that are available to them. And as Representative Vang said, most attorneys that work with tenants are advising them to stay in communication with their landlords and move forward on rent escrow cases if that's what they choose to do. But this is clearing up a situation where when an eviction is already brought by a landlord, that the defenses available to the tenant still remain available. So I would just ask for the committee support in this bill. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3098 be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker Finn?
Aye.
Mueller?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Frazier?
Frazier, aye.
Grossel?
No.
Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
No.
Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Farr?
Farr, no.
Robbins?
No.
Vang?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 7 nays.
The motion prevails. House File 3098 is referred to the General Register. Moving on to our last bill of the day, House File 3972. I will move House File 3972 be referred to the General Register. I will also move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. Any discussion to the DE1? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, the motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Chair Richardson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3972 as amended builds on bipartisan progress we made last year to end discrimination in organ transplant for people with disabilities and extends those protections and civil remedies to ensure non-discrimination and access to transplants based on race or ethnicity. The organ donation system has been failing patients of color through every phase of the process, from getting on the wait list to finding a match to becoming a donor. Patients of color in need of transplants are experiencing different treatment, and the system is rooted in inequity. Research tells us people of color are far more likely to need an organ. Latinx Americans are 1.5 times more likely to have kidney failure. Black Americans are three times more likely to have kidney failure. Native Americans are 4 times more likely to have kidney failure. And Asian Americans are 4 times more likely to have HCC, hepatocellular carcinoma, one of the most common indications for liver transplant. However, people of color are significantly less likely to be put on the wait list and less likely than white patients to receive a life-saving organ transplant once they're on the list. For the sake of time, I'll focus on the disparities Black patients face in nearly every step of the transplant care process for kidney transplants. Black patients are less likely to be identified as a transplant candidate, less likely to be referred for evaluation, less likely to be put on the kidney wait list, less likely to receive a kidney transplant, less likely to receive a higher quality kidney from a living donor, and more likely to receive a lower quality kidney and have poor transplant graft survival rates. During the first signs of kidney failure, the challenges are clear. To get on the wait list, patients must be referred by a physician and be evaluated by a team to determine if they're a suitable candidate. Since there are more people who need organs than supply, difficult choices are made, and the reality is the evaluation system is tainted by racial bias. Before a patient can be added to the kidney waitlist, patients are assessed by their eGFR or their estimated glomerular filtration rate. This number is used to determine the need for a new kidney and to be placed on the waiting list. The standard for white patients is different from the standard from Black patients. This stems from a 20-year flawed data that presumes Black people have higher muscle mass. During this assessment, the race of the patient can only be bucketed into two groups, Black or not Black. In short, patients who are Black automatically have points added to their score, which can make the results appear more normal than they actually are, which in turn delays needed treatment. When you remove the Black race coefficient, transplant referrals occur 1.9 years earlier, and the nephrology threshold occurs for referrals occur 3.6 years earlier. With a push that gained momentum in 2020, some providers are starting to move away from the EGFR standard, which delays treatment for Black patients and impacts their placement on wait lists for a life-saving kidney transplant. Racism is ingrained in the algorithms that dictate access to life-saving treatments. As one provider stated, the criteria for who is prioritized on the wait list is not magically generated. It's made by people on a committee. Research demonstrates that even when you control for general overall health and medical factors and availability of potential living donors for transplants, Black patients are 25% less likely to be listed for transplants than white patients. A person's race or ethnicity should not determine how likely they are to receive an organ they need to survive. And Madam Chair, I don't believe that my testifier was able to make it on today. So with that, that will end my opening remarks.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. We'll move straight to member discussion. We didn't have any other testifiers signed up either. Members, any discussion to the bill? Vice Chair Moeller.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Chair Richardson for bringing this bill. Those statistics are alarming, and of course, behind those statistics are real people. And so I'm really glad you brought this to our attention and looking forward to voting yes.
Thank you. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair. And I also wanted to just thank Chair Richardson for bringing this bill forward. As somebody who manages a chronic kidney condition and I only have 50% function, I'm told that I can potentially get on the wait list when I'm at 10% function. And so I really do appreciate this bill coming forward. I should hope that one day when I need a transplant, that I will not encounter issues because of my race and not being on that list as well. So thank you so much for this bill. It is absolutely needed, Chair Richardson.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Herr. And a good reminder for folks too, if you want, you can be signed up to be a donor. It could be on your driver's license and you can do that now. You don't have to wait until you're in a crisis situation. I know I have family members who have benefited and been donors, and it really is an important thing that we can do that helps other people. Chair Richardson, final comments to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present the bill. And I would just point the members to the number of letters of support that we have received as a result of this bill. And as Representative Moeller has said as well, there's real people behind these statistics, real pain and real loss. And I would just ask for member support.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Richardson, again, for bringing this bill forward. I will renew my motion that 3972 as amended be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Becker Finn?
Aye.
Moeller?
Aye.
Scott? Scott?
Uh-oh, we couldn't. Oh, she's yeah. She's oh, giving aye. A thumbs up for awesome. The record. That is an aye.
Okay. Feist?
Aye.
Frazier? Frazier? Grossel?
Aye.
Herr?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Liebling?
Aye.
Long?
Aye.
Mortensen?
Aye.
Novotny?
Aye.
Farr?
Aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Feng?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
That is 16 ayes and 0
Frazier
nays.
Votes aye.
Oh, okay. Awesome. 17 ayes, 0 nays.
Under the buzzer again, Representative Frazier. Unanimous vote. Congratulations, Chair Richardson. Your bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, everybody. We did it. It's 10 o'clock. Public info won't be mad at me. So thanks again for another really productive week in our committee. With that, we are adjourned.